or sad, or scared that a boat was going to come and make tuna of them. These dolphins were sending their feelings into the world. What if I could see sound waves instead of electricity? What color would dolphin feelings be? Liz said this was the girliest question I've ever asked. I know that cowboys are manly, but why? And somehow dolphin noises are girly? Who writes these rules? Anyhow, maybe the reason people avoid you is because the emotions your brain sends out when you click are kind of negative emotions? Clicking is a nervous habit, and you do it more when you're worried about this kid who follows you home. Is he what folks call a bully? Is there a German word for that? I checked the German dictionary, and it said Tyrann, which sounds like Tyrannosaurus, but he sounds less like an awesome Tyrannosaurus and more like a loser. Maybe you're clicking unhappiness at people, and they're sending it right back in echoes. I hope this doesn't sound dumb. What I'm getting at is some people can be really terrible, but you have to work harder not to let it phase you, because if you let them make you feel that way, you're just adding to the mess of unhappiness in the air. I don't understand why you're so self-conscious. You seem pretty cool to me, even if you are kind of stuffy. I'm wondering what could have happened to make you despise Moritz Farber. Moritz Farber is not even a little boring. Like I said, you've got all the makings of a comic book superhero. If people give you shit for being pretty cool, stand up and peel your goggles off and scare them away. Laugh maniacally and send happy dolphin waves. Actually, I mean it. I think you should try pulling the goggles off sometime. Have you ever done that? If you're so ugly, shut up and hit yourself over the head with the rolled up pages again. You can send them running for the hills. Maybe then you won't have to whimper anymore. Lentz won't stop if you don't stop him. What are you so afraid of? I can't even ride a bike down my driveway, but you can do anything. Anything you want, wherever you want. In fact, your magic brain vision, henceforth called MBV, makes my allergies look pathetic on all fronts. So I'll try to get to the good parts of my story. I'll try to hurry and get to Liz to stop you from talking smack, as kids say. I'm going to rush my earliest years. I want to get to when I was old enough to read, old enough to wonder why the heck I couldn't handle batteries, old enough to stop peeing on household pets. Since you trust my storytelling so much, which is one of the coolest compliments, stories are everything to me. I think I'll tell you three stories from when I was a little kid. Three memories of three accidents that really stick out in my mind. Three's okay, but I kind of wish it were five, because you know who really was a good storyteller? Shakespeare. He wrote plays in five acts. Focus, Ollie. The Linear Autobiography of Oliver Paulot, the Powerless Boy. Part 2. Early Days in Three Accidents. 1. The Fire. Mom used the money from my father's life insurance to buy our cabin in the woods. The cabin is shaped like a triangle. Apparently it's part of some sort of ancient worldwide tradition to let your rooftop trail all the way down to the grass. The almighty A-frame! There's moss and ivy creeping up the roof from the ground, and sometimes it gets mildewy in the peak of the house, where my bedroom makes up the top floor, and it starts to smell a little like pond scum and cedar. Downstairs, there's Mom's bedroom, the kitchen, the living room, and the bathroom, all paneled in dark wood that Mom calls 270s to abide. Maybe that's why she hangs tapestries and quilts and paintings on every surface. There's a porch in the back, and one in the front with an awning that doesn't really offer enough shade in the summertime. The cabin is on the outskirts of Rochdale, Michigan, hours away from where Auburn Stash lives. My whole life long, he's come to check up on me at least twice a month. He's a kook, but I suppose I love him or something. Anyhow, one of my weirdest memories begins with one of those checkups. I've never seen Dr. Auburn Stash drive. He's too careful about my allergies, so he parks the brown smudge of his latest Impala at the end of the two-mile-long driveway. That's some nonsense number of kilometers. I'm just saying that our driveway is more like a long, thin dirt road. Then he buzzes and flits to the house with a suitcase in hand. He doesn't wear a lab coat, which is kind of disappointing. He wears paisley dress shirts and corduroy pants. For a long time, I thought this was how men dressed, but Mom smirks and says Auburn's dash is quirky. Usually I get a standard physical check from him, but he has to be creative about some things. For years, I've had this sort of awkward, deflated mohawk haircut. Not by choice. By the hand of Auburn Stash. Whenever he gives me a physical, he has to look into my ears and nose and mouth without a penlight. You remember how penlights and I don't get along. So he has this wacky old apparatus that's like a small adjustable gas lantern with a pane of magnifying glass in front of it, and a funnel attached to that. He holds that against the side of my head whenever he wants to check my ears for infections. It's his makeshift otoscope. He says having hair on the sides of my head is a fire hazard, but I think he just likes to make me look like a rooster. He used to sit me on his knee out on the front porch, where the light is better. One time, when I was pretty little, Dr. Auburn Stash pressed his otoscope against the side of my head, and I didn't feel like sitting still anymore. So I wriggled away and somehow knocked the otoscope onto the wooden porch, and the lantern shattered. There was a sudden burst of heat as the doormat went up in flames, and then the nearest potted plant, and then the wreath on the open door, and then the carpet in the breezeway. I remember feeling like the fire had a mind of its own, sort of like electricity, like it was out to get me. Good thing Dr. Auburn Stash is always so twitchy, because he bundled me up and flitted and buzzed away from the porch. He deposited me on a stump pretty far away from the cabin and told me to stay, like I was the drooling puppy you compared me to. I think he was going back to rescue Mom, who'd been inside making tea. She needed no rescuing. She strode right out through the fiery doorway and onto the porch with Dorian Gray pinched under her arm, both of them looking more annoyed than anything else. He was clawing her up pretty good. Out on the lawn, she thrust the cat into Auburn Stash's arms before sprinting to the garage to call the fire department. I sat there on the stump, just blinking, watching the flames lick the brick chimney. The roof was catching fire by the time we heard the sirens. I wish I could describe what it looked like. The fire engine, I mean. I thought Mom's car was gritty, but that was before that diesel engine. I could feel the humming electricity even in the soles of my feet, even when it wasn't within sight. I could feel that thing coming like an electric stampede of red weight and light at my temples, and that must have shown on my face because Auburn Stash lifted me up into his arms and jogged me away from it as it pulled up. Dorian Gray was meowing like nobody's business, and Auburn Stash's chest rose and fell like running was the last thing Englishmen in Paisley were used to. There was Mom, staring at our house going up in flames, watching smoke and ash pour from the haven she'd set up for herself and her kid, and she still looked at least halfway exasperated about it all. And I only had eyes for the flashing lights and bleeding black smog that smothered the fire truck. It's what I imagine an old locomotive might look like, if that locomotive came roaring out of hell, like some massive battering ram, all black and red smoke and bursts of white light that churned and spat into oblivion before my watering eyes. Grand! Grand! Read Tolkien. I remember seeing some other amazing things. I saw policemen with walkie-talkies that left trails of saffron dust in the air whenever they buzzed with noise. I remember the blue light atop cars piercing through the clouds around the fire truck, but they didn't look only blue to me. They were spinning fronds of multicolor, fanning streaks of chartreuse and aquamarine that stabbed through puffs of burgundy and umber. I should have looked away. My skull hummed against my brain. My nose was running, my eyes poured, and it had less to do with the fire than it did with the electrical auras buzzing in the air, making me itch from head to toe like I had some sort of volcanic sun rash. But I saw so many colors that night, so many that maybe even you should be a little jealous. Mom wouldn't let anyone near me. She couldn't be sure they weren't stashing phones or tasers in their utility belts. Auburn Stash chuckled when he saw I'd singed the side of my pants, but his eyes were shining. When Mom stomped back over to us, I rounded my shoulders in preparation for an almighty reaming. Mom flew right past me and had Auburn Stash by the shoulders, shaking him.
"What did you do? Another harmless digital watch?"
"Of course not," he protested.
"It was an accident. Electromagnetism wouldn't simply light a fire."
"Don't say of course not, as if you've never pushed him before.
Oliver is not one of your experiments." You don't need to tell me that.
The fire in his eyes was only halfway due to the reflection of the flames behind us.
He isn't your son.
I was gaping at the pair of them because this was a bigger spectacle than the fire, even. Mom and Auburn Stash never fought. They sipped beers on the porch some evenings, got teary-eyed and red-faced when they thought I wasn't peeking down with binoculars. Now Mom was looking at Auburn Stash like he'd been beating me.
Meredith,
he said slowly, eyes reflecting the firelight.
I would never harm him. You have to know that.
Mom let out a laugh like a bark.
I think I can cut Ollie's hair from now on. Please.
The blood left his cheeks, Moritz. I rushed forward and grabbed her elbow.
Mom, he didn't do anything.
She slumped.
Not this time he didn't.
Mom, covered in black ash, let go of Dr. Auburn's stash, wrapped her arms around me, and squeezed too tightly. I could see Dr. Auburn's stash over her shoulder, white against the red-black. We stayed in a tent for a month, which the police thought was weird, but camping out and cooking hot dogs was an adventure while we waited for the cabin to be repaired. When we finally moved back in, Mom set our suitcases down in the untouched living room and sighed.
Even hellfire couldn't kill the 70s.
I threw myself across the orange tartan couch, burying myself in cushions.
Nope.
Mom sat down beside me.
Ollie, look at me.
She was so quiet that I did.
You're too young to remember the digital watch. But if Greg,
Dr. Auburn Stash,
ever tries to show you something electric, you have to tell me right away.
But he's my doctor.
I'm your mother.
I think I was just relieved to hear he'd keep visiting, that I'd get to see color in his face again. We've got a living room covered in bookshelves, Moritz, and one shelf is entirely stacks of encyclopedias. A couple years after Auburn Stash and Mom argued, I read the word electromagnetism. Basically, electromagnetism is as strong a force in the world as gravity. I mean, if you can count on anything, you can count on things falling when you drop them and the air being full of electricity. Subatomically, electric particles are attracting and repelling each other all the dang time. But if I'm allergic to electricity, how come static doesn't kill me? I've had a few shocks in my socks on the wooden kitchen floor, and those didn't give me seizures. And I know about anatomy. There's electricity in our brains, Moritz. Walt Whitman doesn't need to sing any body electric. We're all a little electric already, with or without pacemakers. So how come I'm not permanently dead yet? This is my working theory. My epilepsy isn't due to allergies. It goes beyond that. I don't get along with electricity. I repel it, and it repels me. Nobody's just born that different. It defies science and logic, Moritz. It's just easier to say I'm sick. Easier for Mom to coop me up like an invalid. So you have to tell me about the laboratory, Moritz. Even if it bores you. I'm not needling you now. I'm asking you. If you were created in a lab, was I created there too? I mean, how else are you and I connected? What else can explain the mess I'm in? If I'm an experiment like you, I need to explain that to Liz. I need her to know that there were bigger issues than me being a walking disaster to excuse, well, not excuse, but to explain that I couldn't help what happened when we went camping. I couldn't help her, and I couldn't...
Focus.
I'm puffing on my bubble pipe, Watson. 2. Junkyard Joe. Mom put up no trespassing signs everywhere around our property. You know, the kind that said, violators will be shot. Which I don't think is legal, but made for a decent threat. The reason that signs like these were even necessary had a lot to do with open season. Do people hunt in Germany, Moritz? When I try to imagine it, I think of men in pantaloons prancing around chasing stags, like on Mom's tapestries. Anyhow, open season here is a big deal. There are a lot of white-tailed deer in the forests, and every November people travel here with beer bottles and rifles and tarps in tow. They say they're after 10-point bucks, but it's really more about getting drunk with your buddies and sitting in trees, Auburn Stash says. He's not the hunting type. Too British or something. The last thing Mom wanted was a hunter stumbling near our cabin. Most moms would be worried about drunks carrying guns. She was more worried about drunks carrying flashlights. Well, sure enough, when I was 7 or so, some man wearing camouflage walked onto our property with a rifle over his shoulder. Mom was teaching me how to bike ride. I still had training wheels on the back, but I was getting really into pedaling as fast as I could and then braking hard enough to leave deep gouges of tire tracks in the dirt driveway. Mom jogged along behind me, always watchful. On an autumn day, when the leaves smelled wet and rich and they were browning in the driveway, I pedaled slowly to put her at ease. I hear a woodpecker, Mom. She kicked at the leaves. Really? I don't hear a thing. Listen! Nah, I'd rather smell. Smell that air. She closed her eyes. And when she opened them, I was pedaling away as fast as possible. She shouted my name. I hadn't gotten all that far ahead when the hunter in orange appeared right in front of me, stepping out from between the pines. His eyes widened. I could see that something electric was glowing lime-like in his pockets, so I slammed on the brakes and spun out, and the next thing I knew I was being carried and my head hurt, and I'd scraped my face along the dirt. "This ain't your property," said the man who held me. Not the hunter, but someone else. I was too spaced out to recognize him. "Go on before I report you. Police in this town are always looking to find idiot flatlanders, you know." I could see the treetops and a scraggly chin overhead. I don't know if the hunter, the flatlander, vamoosed or not. "What's going on?" I said. It could have been right then, or it could have been minutes later. Sparks were in my eyes, rattling my teeth in my ears. "Got yourself a nice concussion. And here comes your mom, looking likely to give you another one." I heard her call my name, and the next thing I knew, I was in her arms instead, out on the porch and woozy still, and leaning over her shoulder was all the rest of the scraggle chin, Junkyard Joe. Joe, a bearded mechanic who perpetually wore a baseball cap, was our only neighbor, although his trailer and junkyard are a mile away. He didn't mind Mom's signs. Last thing he wanted was more hunters on his turf. As far as he was concerned, all that deer meat was his. He used to stop by to drop off Tupperware containers full of chewy venison stew. "Rise and shine, Sonny Jim," he said, showing off his missing teeth. I blinked. "Can you hear me?" Mom's voice was so loud, this close to me. I nodded, but it felt like half my face had been torn to shreds. "Just look at you. Now people will think we're abusing you." She pulled me closer. "If you ever run away like that again, I don't know what I'll do. So don't. Never again." This might have been when Mom started putting padlocks on the door, Mo. Eventually, Mom tucked me into bed, but it was early afternoon and I wasn't sleepy. Mom and Joe were on the back porch. My window was open. It was a warm day and the wind was blowing leaves against the screen, and Mom was right. They smelled pretty great. "Thanks for your help, Joe. Just looking out for my neighbors. Keep an eye on your boy." "I'm trying. If I don't, he'll vanish. Gone before I know him."
"Aw, it won't happen like that. He getting any better?"
Mom must have shaken her head. I shied away from the window.
"Maybe I'll have him meet my niece sometime. She's around his age. Name's Elizabeth."
"Yes," said Mom after a second. "Maybe." Okay, so next I was going to tell you a story about the one time I had a babysitter and it was a big disaster, but I've changed my mind. Because the Elizabeth who Joe mentioned was the Liz I'm always going on about, so jumping right ahead to the day I met her is still more or less being linear. And I have to clear her name. I have to tell you what she means to me. I have to tell you why I wait at the end of the driveway every Wednesday. 3. The Girl. Playing huntsman in the woods is a lot less fun when your mother's sneaking along behind you, lurking beneath trees with all the grace of a drunken amputee. But if I was in my bedroom, Mom checked on me almost every 7 minutes. Sometimes she brought warm macaroni from the wood stove or cold milk from the garage. I told you she has hobbies. She's got a brain like mine, a brain that wants to be busy all the time. She knits, sews, paints, crafts model train layouts, collects flowers and presses them, makes mobiles and pottery, and binds books. But her favorite hobby is watching me, I think. She watched me from my bed while I studied, or folded, or drew at my desk. Occasionally, she spoke. More often, she only peered at me with fingers on her lips, that expression, you know which one, on her face. "Can you go do something else?" "Can is a fun word," she answered. "But if I can put up with you, you can put up with me." She told me once, when I asked about Dad, that she'd promised not to trap me. Whether my dad wanted what was best or worst for me, I don't know. He died and left us enough money to live on, but with one condition. If I ever decided to go, Mom must let me. He put it in his will. Mom can't just keep me here forever. She promised him. But the way Mom looked at me, I didn't think she could keep that promise. Maybe that's why I was always trying to leave. I was almost 11 when Mom finally let me take the training wheels off my bicycle. She and I played mechanic. Mom used to be a lot more playful. She lay down on her back on the grass with the bike frame over her nose while I watched, suck chewing a banana. "Screwdriver," she cried. "Don't you need a wrench first?" I passed her my banana peel and she didn't flinch, just dropped it and held her hand out again. "Scalpel, but you're not a doctor." I held out the socket wrench. "Doctors have goatees, stashes of auburn." Her fingertips were cold when she took it, because even in those days her circulation wasn't great. The rusty bolts ground when she twisted them. "Ollie, does Dr. Auburn Stash talk to you about the past?" "I wish. He's too scared of you to answer my lab attacks." "He'd better be." It was a murmur, but I could hear it under the clicking of the tool in her hand. "Isn't he your friend, Mom?"
"Not exactly, Ollie."
"Then, what are friends like? Do you think I'll ever have any?" I was smiling, but Mom dropped the wrench. She frowned at me through the wheel axle.
"I wish that, well, for now you have me, Ollie."
"Better than nothing?"
"S'pose."
I grinned wide to scrunch up my eyes because for some reason they were damp and I didn't want her to see that.
"S'pose you'll do.
Tell me about Dad."
"Needling immunity."
Mom inched out from under the bike frame and stood up to look at it.
"There. But you have to be careful. If you kick up the kickstand now, the bike will just fall over."
"That's okay. Mom?" She was wiping her eyes, just staring at that bike. I felt like if I climbed on it, she'd push me right off it again. Or she was fighting a powerful urge to reattach the training wheels or cement the whole frame to the ground. I let myself fall to lean against her. She put a foot out to her left to catch herself.
"I'll be your kickstand."
She snorted and rested her elbow, articulatio cubiti, in my hair. The bone was sharp.
"Nah, you're my armrest. You aren't going anywhere."
Mom means well, but do you see why I couldn't buy her promises, Moritz? I'm a lousy kickstand. A few days later, I stole the keys from their most recent hiding place on the second oak bookshelf. I always find them. Burst out onto the lawn and pulled the bike from the tangled hoses in the shed. I pedaled down the driveway that led out of the woods. Tree roots jutted into the path. They looked a lot like outstretched hands. Every time I ran one over, I thought I was running over someone's fingers. It wasn't just about escaping Mom. I was chasing after humidifiers, semi-trucks and cash registers, stereos and movie theaters and tablets and tennis shoes with lights in them. I wanted to see the things everyone else saw, even if it was just from a distance. I wanted the world. That power line halfway down the driveway all but blew me off my bike. Orange electrical tendrils dangled from the overhanging cable, probably draping from the wire like your goth bangs drape across your forehead, Mo. The moment I neared them, my stomach clenched up. Definitely we had opposing charges, that power line in me. A spasm went through my right foot. It slipped from the pedal. It was like the tendrils had grabbed me, had wrapped hot wires around my cranium and squeezed. The roots on the path had done nothing, but that silver cable in the sky threw me sidelong into the ferns. But just as there had been something hypnotic about the laptop, there was something about those billowing tangerine tendrils that made me determined to cross them, even if their licks left me twitching. "This isn't over," I told the power line. And so began our legendary rivalry. When I returned to the break in the pines, I rode one-handed with an old fishbowl lodged under my other arm. Dorian Gray had shown the betta fish it once held a proper burial inside his stomach. I dismounted, let the bike fall, and shoved the bowl over my head. It caught on my ears. I fought it down. Soon my breath was fogging up my vision. Trying not to tremble beneath my makeshift helmet, I approached the tangerine agitators that swung from the power line. I'd read pamphlets about hazmat and NBC suits, about scientifically insulated clothes, although Mom always told me they just weren't worth the risk, whatever. I'd also read that glass doesn't conduct electricity. Besides, glass seems to work for spacemen, right? Liz must have been laughing at me. She lived in town, but her father loved blackberry pie, and there are lots of berry patches near our driveway. Picking berries wasn't really what other kids did on the weekends, but Liz wasn't other kids, Mo. I didn't see her standing in the ferns watching me. I assumed that no one was around because no one ever was. Liz crept up beside me while I was craning my neck to stare at my ropey nemesis. She could have taught Mom something about being quiet, or else the glass muffled sound pretty well, because I didn't even notice her until she pressed her face close to the fishbowl and hollered, "Going deep-sea diving?" The sound echoed in my ears. I fell backward into the leaves. "What the heck are you wearing?" I wiped pine needles from my palms and raised my eyes to her. Through the distorted glass, she could have been anyone, anything. I pulled the bowl off my head. She was the girl I'd seen with the laptop. Her dark hair was tied back in a ponytail. Her tanned face was freckled, completely at odds with my pasty complexion. She was wearing short overalls with pockets full of blackberries that were staining the jean fabric purple. One dirty kneecap had a wet leaf stuck to it. "Oh, no," her expression softened. "You aren't developmentally disabled, are you? Do you maybe suffer from a mental impairment?" "No. Oh, well, my parents are both social workers. My mom works crisis calls, which means she stops people from killing themselves." Liz smiled. I'm sure she thought it was reassuring, but it was such a wide smile. "If you have a mental illness, I'm totally cool with it. I could probably even help you with it." "I'm not mental." My ears were burning. "And you are?" "I'm sick. Allergic to electricity." Liz raised her eyebrows. "So you are crazy." "No." I stood up on wobbling legs and pointed at the power line. "Watch." I ran full tilt at the break in the trees. It was the most reckless thing I'd ever done. And when the tendrils tossed me back and I ended up shaking on the forest floor with a nosebleed, I was amazed that I'd suffered nothing worse. "Whoa! That was weird. Almost like you hit an invisible wall or something. Did it hurt?" I nodded. "Cool." My face flushed. "But that's not why I said you were crazy." She suddenly became stern. "I said you're crazy because you said your illness before you said your name. That's like one of my dad's clients." She pointed a reprimanding finger at me. "Do not define yourself by your illness, Mr. Oliver. "I'm Liz." She reached a hand out. I thought she was going to help me up, but she proffered juicy purple berries. "You want some, Ollie? Or do you want to sit there and bleed some more?" "Thank you." I plopped one berry into my mouth, but I could taste blood over top of it. "Thanks a lot,"
No biggie, Ollie. It was a biggie, Moritz. She had no idea how big of a biggie. Tomorrow is Wednesday, so maybe Liz will stop by. Or maybe not. I mean, it's okay either way. It's not like I don't have anything else to do. I've been trying to get into origami, but I can't even begin to fold the dragons right, because you're supposed to build them up from cranes, but every time I fold a crane it goes all saggy in the middle. It's taking up a lot of time. It's better than just lying around and tearing my hair out, though. You have to tell me more about whatever else is worth knowing about your life and times in Kreisig. Cure the boredom again, won't you? Ollie. P.S. Hey, why do you have a scar behind your ear? Was that Lentz or the laboratory? You can't just tell me you aren't interested in secret labs and then strongly hint that people did actual experiments on you. That's like dangling the carrot after cutting the donkey's legs off. Please, Moritz. There's no one else for me to ask. Just squirrels and trees. Hey?
Chapter 6 The Words.
Why, Oliver? Why did I listen to you? You complete cat pisser! I am not implying the use of italics. I am shouting at you! I am writing this damned letter after being awarded a 1-week suspension from Bernholt Regen Hauptschule pending my potential expulsion. I am sitting alone in my apartment with a bloodied nose and battered face, both of which I hold you responsible for. But why should you care? I'm not boring you. I was so pleased about your last letter. That is why I have acted like a fool. Acted as you might have. When someone tells you for the first time in your existence that you are heroic, it is difficult to remain sensible. That charming nature of yours has made an arse of me. You don't understand me, Oliver, any more than you understand the world. I can only hope that your dreadful advice was not an act of cruelty, but of ignorance. But if my hopes are justified, how terrible. It is as if your ignorance is being passed to me simply because you wrote something that moved me. I am furious. But then, I am also to blame. I chose to trust you. You have a misleading tendency to sound wise. But what could you possibly know? All the words you have ever written to me are words you learned in books. Words you learned in a cabin far removed from the real world. Or they are something worse. They are words you learned from a teenage girl who strings you along like you are a mindless plaything. Are you eating, Ollie? Why is getting out of bed a victory? You try so hard to sound happy, but what would you do without distractions? Are you so lovesick that you would whimper for eternity if Liz never returned? You are the one who needs to stand up. So how could I find solace in your words? You have never gone to school. You have never had objects thrown at your head. You have never watched your classmates feign illness, coughing and spitting and sighing when they are assigned your partner during science courses. You have never walked through an indifferent city in the afternoon and waited for Lentz Monk to knock you down, worried that the whooshing of the wind might obscure some of his movement. You have never hurried home on cold afternoons with eyes on your back, when you can almost feel hands clawing at you and snagging at your hemlines, the hands of someone who is itching to grab you, just to hear you shout. MBV does have some benefits. MBV tells me whether someone is looming along the path up ahead, whether someone is following me. I can hear their paces quickening, footsteps. The sound makes my heart strain, my lungs soften, rattles my very brain, Oliver. But you wouldn't know anything about this. You have not seen the shape of words in echolocation. It is not the same as seeing electricity. It is not beautiful. Freak bounces off every surface until it reaches me. It seeps right into my forehead. Fag pierces me in the chest, coils around my loins, my fluttering heart. Retard is one I can hear forming on lips. I see it in the spittle that casts it out, because I click, click, click my tongue twice as much when I think someone might utter it. Retard. To say nothing of the laboratory. You ask why I am scarred? You wonder about my heroic origins? What a fun mystery! I am scarred because when I was small, people in that laboratory cut me and put electric machines inside my skull. For the sake of science. Are you pleased, you asked? You want to know more? Do you really hope that you and I have that place in common? You say people may be cruel to me because I poison the air with, what, negative energy? You imply that the way others treat me might be my fault? Because I show them I am afraid? How can I help but show that when I can hardly breathe and sweat pours off me and I wish only that I could close eyes I don't have so that I don't have to see the looks on their faces? You don't have to tell me I deserve this. I know that already. Fick dich, Oliver. To think I had begun to consider you a friend. Our parents wanted our letters to be medicinal. This is bad medicine. I want no further part of you. Consider this the end of our correspondence.
Chapter 7. The Cabin. Okay, you need to calm down. Part of me is afraid to say anything that might upset you more, but part of me wants to scream right back at you. All of me is wondering if you've gotten any help. Where's your dad while you're busy bleeding all over and screaming? You're sitting all alone in your apartment? Have you told anyone else about Lentz Monk? Anyone who isn't powerless? Or do you just close your mouth and accept it? So what the hell happened? What triggered this? I would never say you deserve to be hurt, so why are you saying it? I may have an attention deficit or whatever, but I think you might have manic depression or a mood disorder, Moritz. I've read about these things, and I don't pretend to be an expert, but I think you should get a counselor or social worker or psychiatrist to help you if you haven't already. I even asked Auburn Stash to have a look at your last letter, but that was pretty pointless. Here is what he said while taking my pulse. Sometimes friends in crappy situations can be unfriendly and crappy themselves. I'm worried about you, and it sucks that I can't do anything about it. Maybe we've never met and never will, but I think I've made it clear that I want to be your friend. And if friends are just crappy to each other, I guess I'm allowed to be a bit crappy too. So I'll tell you that I won't be sorry until you tell me what happened and why you got suspended and how on earth that's supposed to be my fault. You're right. I don't know much about how other kids act around one another. I've never stood in a classroom. I've never waited at a freaking bus stop. So maybe I am the worst person to listen to. But I think you're taking this out on me because you're too scared to face the people who actually hurt you. Like the people in the lab I don't know about, I guess. Do us both a favor and tell me what the hell happened before you start screaming at me. Because here's the truth about how I feel about our correspondence so far. I have been really honest with you. But you, Moritz? You talk around everything like you're talking in those waves you see by. You don't say what you mean. You pull your punches. You say you don't want to hurt my simple ears. I call bullshit. You're just too scared to trust me because you think if I ever met you, I might shove you into a drinking fountain just like Lentz does. As if I needed one more reason to feel like a leper. Next time you talk to me, actually talk to me. If you really don't want to write to me anymore, I guess that's okay. I mean, I'm getting pretty used to the whole abandonment thing. It's been 4 months since I last saw Liz. 4 months since she stopped by after school and told me how her days were booked with basketball games and acting competitions, and basically filled with lots of people who aren't powerless. Anyhow,
I hear the word freak all the time. I hear it in this empty house. It's so quiet here sometimes.
You would be blind. You think my talk fills up the space? Who is there to talk to?
And you know what? I'm not sorry about asking about the lab. It's easy for you to ignore because you have other distractions. It's easy for you to just forget about where you came from because you're going to go other places.
I may never get out of here, Moritz. What do I have to look forward to but the past?
Sorry I told you to enjoy the real world. Sorry I told you not to take being surrounded by people for granted.
Mom says she feels like maybe I shouldn't have tried writing you to begin with. She's trying to lock this door like she does all the others. She says I shouldn't even reply.
But there's not really much to lose if you're already ditching out.
As for my terrible advice, I told you to stand up and face your troubles. Blaming your troubles on me isn't heroic at all.
You could have had a cape and mask, Moritz.
I guess I thought you were braver than this.
Chapter 8. The Goggles. Ollie. May I call you Ollie? As an apology? I do not have a lot of experience with apologies or friendship. I do not know where to begin. I was prepared never to speak to you again when I wrote that last letter. Because you'll never meet me, I wrote like a coward. Wrote knowing that you could not fight my accusations, at least not to my empty face. But after I screamed at you, you replied first with concern. That was humbling. I am 2 years older than you, Ollie. I don't feel those years. You could not let me rot. Thank you, Ollie. No, I do not have a psychiatrist. I have no intention of contacting one. I admit that my temperament is sometimes unstable. I attribute this to unfortunate genetics, a troubled upbringing. I have had enough of people in lab coats. A doctor regularly visits to ensure that my pacemaker is functioning. Beyond him, I will have no one. But I am grateful for your concern. Father is concerned as well, quietly. Sometimes when I sit on the balcony listening to Kreiszig at rush hour, cars and horns and the echoes of footsteps far below, he sits beside me. He puts his hand on my shoulder. But family is compulsory. Family that does not care is not family. Perhaps friends who do care are something more than family? How sanctimonious I sound. Let me speak plainly. I appreciate your friendship. Apologies for making an awkward dirge of it. Did I deserve all your reprimands? Firstly, I resent the accusation that I do not trust you. I may never be the extrovert that you are, but I am learning to trust you. You know more about me than almost anyone. Secondly, you aren't being objective. As much as I admire your honest writing, you aren't always honest with yourself, Ollie. Let me elaborate. You say you see no point in dwelling on things you can't have, but you think of these things constantly. Take the internet. You insult it. You express a desire to see it. Then you claim a lack of interest once more. Why pretend? Can you tell me to treat my temper when you are so contradictory? Hypocrisy. Perhaps I vented my anger at my circumstances on you. You have done the same to me by feigning happiness. Trying to be funny even when you are in pain. I am not a hero, and you should not pretend to be one. Wearing a mask cannot change that you are wincing underneath it. I would like to visit your empty house, to give you someone to be noisy to. I cannot. So when you write, be angry, be upset. How else will I ever meet you? Which brings me to Liz. She seems charming, in a way. But you cannot decide that without her there is no future. I am trying to withhold judgment until I hear more. Is she entirely composed of confidence? I don't speak in school. Yes, perhaps a brooding smog of unhappiness permeates the air around me. In my defense, no one ever reached out to me like Liz did to you, with berries or a hand or anything else. Hearing how you met, how she supported you while you fought to overcome that power line, armed only with resentment and a fishbowl, I longed to be half so heroic as the pair of you. Let me tell you why I blamed you. Let me tell you about the miraculous moment that inspired this apology. Let me counter your story with a nosebleed fable of my own. I went to school a week ago with your letter at the forefront of my thoughts. I tried to emit your invisible dolphin waves of happiness as I crossed the concrete courtyard of Bernholt Regan. I held my head straight, tucked my hair behind my ears. For once, my goggles and forehead were exposed. No one took notice. The students around me carried on chewing their cheeks in the oily halls and cramped classrooms, idiotic as usual. I saw a Linz monk leaning against a toilet door, doubtless trapping some unfortunate soul inside. I waved to him. He blinked at me, but let me pass without a whimper. During athletics hour, I was eliminated early from a game of dodgeball and took a seat along the sweat-stenched bleachers beside my fallen comrades. I could easily win at dodgeball if I chose to. MBV allows me to see the trajectory of a ball the moment it leaves someone's fingertips, especially in a noisy Hauptschule gymnasium. I could win. I dislike drawing that sort of attention. I am no longer anyone's experiment. Small steps. I nodded to the person sitting beside me, a notoriously quiet boy, Owen Arbend. I notice him for the sake of his silence. When I sit alone in the cafeteria, I can pick him out of a crowd. He appears as a dip in my sight. Not a hole, but the slightest dent of a body, perpetually quieter. Owen blinked at me, quietly, of course, but he didn't flinch. Lenz got eliminated with the smack of a ball to his chest. My teammates patted him on the shoulder. I raised my voice alongside the rest. Perhaps next time. His eyes narrowed. Soon he loomed over me. Allow me to describe Lenz Monk. He smells of cigarettes and sweet pumpernickel bread. He is large, far larger than me. I am short for my age, and about as thick as the combined flimsy pages of the letter you urged me to hit myself with. His shoulders are rounded. One of his eyes moves more slowly than the other. He is ugly, but who am I to say so? I forced a smile. A valiant effort. He tried to shove me in the chest, likely just to push past me. He does not usually act when many people are present. He torments in private. I should have been safe, had I not reacted. Understand that I have the quickest reflexes, Ollie. When every minuscule movement made by another person is apparent to your brain the very instant it occurs, and sometimes the moment before it occurs, your natural impulse is simply to respond, without conscious thought. The moment he raised his hand, I was bending my torso out of his way. He hit only empty air, tripped forward a step or two. One boy laughed. Owen Arbend put his hand over his mouth. It was, to quote your Liz, no biggie. Lenz Monk disagreed. He punched me in the face. MBV meant I could have ducked under his fist. I could have countered him with one of my own punches before he realized he had swung past me into the wide-eyed bunches of students watching from the bleachers behind me. I might have slipped from the meaty fingers that clutched at my collarbone, darted in, quick and close, left a demeaning kiss on his nose tip. So why did I take the punch right under my right lens? Why did I let his heavy fist dislodge my goggles? Set my nose to spitting blood, my cheekbones to creaking? Because, in that precise moment, I remembered you. You ran straight at that power line, and no demeaning peck could do the damage to him that my sudden unveiling could. The punch landed me on the polished floor. I peeled my goggles away, pushed them over my forehead until they pulled my long bangs up and away, held my bloody nose to my sleeve, and lifted my head high enough for Lens to see the nothingness. Because you told me to, Ollie. Because that could be my superpower, yes? Under my breath, I was clicking. But I did not replace my goggles. MBV revealed Lens's expression in excruciating detail. His face nearly curdled. His disgust crept down from his brow and coagulated around his nose before slipping down to pull the corners of his mouth away from his teeth. Teeth fell open so that he could let sound slip out between them. Sound that made his horror so clear to me. Behind us, the crowd craned forward in a synchronized motion, not unlike the wave audiences form during sports matches. But everyone recoiled twice as quickly. I saw one girl actually trip over the bleachers backward, but while she caught the heel of her foot on the step, I was also seeing Lens's horrified face, twisted in high definition, and I was also seeing my gym teacher, Herr Gabor, stomping toward us from the locker room with one of his shoelaces untied, and I was also seeing a moth flitter about high, high above us. And I was also seeing a million dust motes collect on the rafters, and seeing how Owen Arben's eyes widened, and seeing how the stream of warm blood caught and pooled in the pocket between my bottom lip and my gums, and seeing the aimless patterns in the polished wood grain beneath my feet and tailbone, and very nearly almost seeing straight through Lens's pores to his gaping skull underneath. The scientists were not completely wrong about my brain. When I am upset, I cannot focus my MBV on any single thing. The sound and fury of everything simply pours into my head from all directions while I click my confounded tongue. Seeing everything at once makes my head hurt and my heart flutter. This is the worst possible thing. My simple-minded heart, my struggling pacemaker. For an instant, Lens was motionless. Then he smashed my face into the floor. It hurt so much I could hardly feel it, as if my body turned my pain receptors to ice. My goggles broke against my forehead, the right lens popped free from the frames. They slipped from my head, scratching and tearing my face in stinging lines as they peeled away. People shouted, cheering Lens on. It was so noisy with their words. I could see the drool in the backs of their throats when they hollered. They rooted to see my face caved in. Watching a live freak fag retard's face avalanche is quality entertainment. Regardless of whether you've got MBV or 20/20 vision, or you have to squint through glasses. Freak! Lens spat. A great yanking at my upper arm. Herr Gabor pulled us apart. He glanced at my face and swore beneath his breath before releasing me, Ollie. Deprived of my goggles, I scratched my hair down over my eyes. Scratched and clicked and scratched and clicked. One person kept her head. One of the few people I somehow lost sight of in my frantic haphazard MBV. She grabbed me beneath the arms, hoisted me to my feet. Frau Pruitt looked me dead in the face as if I had eyes she could meet. I know that there's a customary cliché about librarians being what crass people might call hard asses. Frau Pruitt is granite. Had I tentacles underneath my goggles, she would not have batted one eyelash. She must have heard the fuss from the hallway. She unceremoniously shoved a wad of tissues right under my gory nose, pursed her lips. "A tussle, Mr. Farber?" she sighed. "Come along, then." I was still seeing too much while I was dragged to the headmaster's office through throngs of pupils who parted like Moses's sea before us. Seeing so much, I felt as if my head would divide itself just as the crowd did. My jerking heart might do the same. Imbecilic thing. At some point, I was deposited in the headmaster's office. I understood through the haze that I had been suspended. I was left to wait and catch my breath and brain and heart rate on an uncomfortable sofa in the hallway outside the main office, left to hear the sound of mites in the brown carpet clicking away in time with my own clicking, click, clicking. On the opposite side of a glass wall behind me, I could see, hear men and women in the office, whispering. One man, my history instructor, clutched his rumbling stomach, as if the sight of me made him downright unwell. But he must be blind. He's still making that sound. What is that, a tick? Why don't we have more information about this? He should have accommodations in place. His guardian only told us he was photosensitive. When he was enrolled, that was all. My physics teacher. I thought the goggles were a harmless affectation. He doesn't have many friends. If he wanted to use photosensitivity as an excuse, I couldn't blame him. I had no inkling that he was actually... We'll be held accountable. A plan should have been in place. Aside from all the rest, he has a pacemaker. Of course he'll be at a disadvantage among normal students. Oh, normal students, Ollie. I finally despised you then, Ollie. My head was tearing itself asunder. I could not filter a single whispering thing out. The thing about having no eyes is that you can never close them. I clamped my hands over my ears, tried to hear only my irregular heartbeat, the gentle buzzing of my pacemaker, the air whooshing through my lungs, the blood pulsing through my veins and arteries, the sounds of my skeleton, the sounds that I am never rid of. In my lap were my battered goggles. Frau Pruitt waited beside me, arms folded. "Cheer up, son," she said gruffly, without looking at me. "Soon be Christmas. It is February." It was only after I sent you the enraged letter that I remembered something vital. There were too many stimuli in that gym that day, Ollie. Too much noise. It took me until late that night to think clearly about all that I'd witnessed and experienced. But the goggles. I couldn't remember picking up the goggles. They were torn from me. How did I end up clutching them again? After Herr Gabor pulled lens off me, something miraculous occurred. Something wondrous. My appreciation for language rarely has need of the word wondrous. Before I was dragged to the office with the fearsome librarian, someone stopped me in the doorway. Owen Arbend. A poke on the shoulder. He shoved my goggles into my hand. He had taken the time to pop the dislodged lens back into place. Perhaps school will not be so unbearable when I return, when my suspension ends. Or is this only your optimism tainting me again? In any case, it is not the worst thing I have felt. Please do write me soon. Sincerely, Moritz.
Chapter 9.
the woods. Please don't apologize to me. It makes me downright squeamish. Yuck, man. Yuck. I agree with you that I don't deserve it, really, so enough of that nonsense. And I already told you to call me Ollie. I got your very angry letter on a Wednesday. I may have mentioned that Wednesdays used to be the days that Liz came